Okay, we're now recording. Today is Thursday, June 2nd. This is Trinity Gibbons at the University of Texas at Austin, and I am interviewing Olympic track and field athlete Lois Thompson, formerly Lois Drinkwater, over the phone in order to record her experiences and reflections of the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. All right. So to get started today, let's just go ahead and get some basic biographical and background information about you. Let's just start with when and where you were born.
I was born in Phoenix, Arizona in 1951.
Do you want to talk a little bit about your parents and how growing up?
My mom and dad were Alice and Herb Drinkwater. They moved to Phoenix from Batavia, New York, because my brother Herb Drinkwater had asthma so bad they told him he would not live if they didn't take him to a dry climate. So in 1942, they put their three children in a car, and it took them 10 days because of rationing of gas and tires to come to Phoenix. They didn't really have any job. My dad was a high school math teacher. He had the promise of one, but not for sure. When they first got here, they had to live in a house or a hotel that backed up to the concentration camps for the prisoners of war. So they had quite an experience, and I wasn't born until after they moved here.
Interesting. What about your early athletic and sporting experiences? How did you get into participating in athletics?
Well, I started running track in third grade because my older brother, Stuart Drinkwater, was fast. And Miss Harris and Coach Farley knew that I had to be fast, too, so they started me running the grade school track program once a year through 8th grade. And then in 8th grade, Ms. Harris decided that I could learn how to high jump. And I went to what was then called the AAU, the track meet. And I was kind of recruited to run. And my brother stood and made sure I got to practice every day from the end of my 8th grade on until I could drive my own car.
That's great. So I know you were quite young when you participated in the Olympics, but can you talk a little bit about what you were doing the year prior to the Olympic Games?
The year prior, I was a junior in high school. I was only 17 when I made the team, which last time I looked was one of the four youngest women to ever make a U.S. track and field team. There were two 15-year-olds and two 17-year-olds. And this was before the last Olympics. What I remember that year before I made my first U.S. track and field team and represented the U.S. and the United States versus British Commonwealth. It was supposed to be against the USSR, but they had boycotted the meet and didn't come. So we quickly, I guess the United States hustled and got the British Commonwealth. So I had one international meet under my belt, so to speak, before I started running in the Olympics.
Can you describe your life a little bit before making the team?
I worked with the Phoenix Track Club. Mm-hmm. Mr. Fred Moore was my coach, and there were about 12 of us that trained with him, and we were really dedicated. He never believed in days off, so we had practice on Thanksgiving and Christmas every day of the year. We might take a week off in August before we started training for cross country. We all ran cross country. We did indoor track, and then we did the outdoor track. So we were pretty much busy every day working out. You know, I was an honors high school student. And my math and English classes were pretty demanding. And when I made the team, we missed that whole first term of school. So I was out for a quarter while we trained in Los Alamos, New Mexico for high altitude training, and then went on to the Olympic Games themselves.
Describe, you talked about making the Olympic team. Can you talk a little bit about that process, the selection process, and the actual Olympic trials?
Well, we had to qualify for nationals. Our nationals that year were in Denver, and the format at that time was 2 days of 14 through 17-year-old girls nationals, a day of rest, and then 2 days of women's. And Fred Moore, again, wanted to make sure I wasn't overrun and that I was peaked and I was ready to run for the biggest races of my life. So in the girls, I did not run the 400 meters, which was my event. I ran 4x1 and the 100. And it was a real surprise and upset because I'm not supposed to be all that quick like the short sprinters are. But I ended up winning the 100. I think I ran something like a 10.800 yard time, which was pretty impressive, but that's all old handhill times. So I don't know how accurate that time was. And then we went on to nationals, to the women's nationals, you know, the 2 days. And I was, I want to say I was second in the 400, and Jarvis Scott was first. And Esther Stroy, I think, was third. So that qualified me to go a week or so later to the trials at Mount San Antonio in California. So then it was a lot of stress. Now, remember, I was only 17. It was a lot of stress, and my goal had been, for the last 4 years, had been to make the team, and that was my goal. And at the trials, and we went through prelims and all, and at that time you weren't seated into lanes. You just drew for lane, and I drew the outside lane. So the 400 meters, that would mean I was way out there on the stagger, and I did not see anybody in the entire race until I would come off the last curve. So I had my teammates stand at the 300 mark and scream at me to kick because I was going to see them if I came off that curve, and if I saw them, if they did catch me too soon, then I wasn't going to make the team. So I managed to have a good kick, finished second again behind Robert Scott. And my dad, my mother, and my sister Barbara were there. My dad had a bad leg, but I remember looking up in the stands, and he ran down to the finish line. And my teammate, Judy Rajabian, was there, and had told me when I made the team, because she knew I was going to make the team. She had something for me. So at the finish line, I was, you know, surrounded by my friends and teammates, my family, and she gave me an Olympic coin that the Mexico government had minted for the Olympics, and I have carried that since that day in my purse, and it's my good luck charm.
Wow, that's really cool. We talked a little bit about it, but how did your family and your friends and even your community feel about you making the team?
Well, Phoenix was a small town then, and we didn't have many opportunities for women in athletics. At my high school, Central High School, I think we had tennis and archery, and I think that was about it, unless you wanted to be a cheerleader or a pom-pom girl. And I was the last girl cut from the tennis team, which is probably the best thing that happened to me my freshman year, because then I focused on track instead of trying to do two different sports. My mom and dad weren't particularly athletic. My dad was born in England. He was the first one in his family to ever go to college. They, at Hamilton Calmus College in New York, they wanted him to be on the hockey team, but he had to work to support himself and put himself through school. So nobody in my family really did sports like I did. So I don't think they knew what to think of me. My dad would always tell me, oh, you ran real well, you did a good job, and no matter what I did, it was good. And I would say, Dad, I ran terrible, that wasn't a good race. But he was just always real accepting of what I did. But I don't think they really thought I would make the team, that I would be that good. And then my friends, again, my friend Judy with Jamie, you know, was sure was going to make it. My teammate Jan Glotzer just missed qualifying. She would have an alternate, but she didn't make the qualifying standard for the games. We were a really competitive, small team. And for that kind of quality to come out of Phoenix, Arizona, and track and field at that time was amazing. There just wasn't. There wasn't that any competition here. We didn't even have it in high school sport. We had to travel to Los Angeles or Albuquerque and go to the meets. We had to go to San Francisco. And our parents had to put a lot of money up to make sure that we got to those meets so we had the competition to get us to the international and United States top level. And if without our coach, Fred Moore, we would have never made it. He was a phenomenal coach, and he always said he didn't know that much. He was just learning along with us, and he practiced on. And every year, he tried a different training technique. He would change the whole program, and we were still at the top, which is pretty amazing when you stop and think about it, that in 1966, 67, there really weren't many places for women to do any kind of running.
That is incredible. I can't even imagine it. Can you relate some of your most memorable experiences leading up to the 68 games, or any problems that you had leading up to your departure to Mexico City?
Well, I think one of the things, you know, high altitude. So they took us to Los Alamos, New Mexico, for high altitude training. And we lived in that little town, you know, town that's where the Atomic Energy Commission is.
Mm-hmm.
It was really a small town in the middle of nowhere, but there wasn't any competition either. And to really get ready to compete, you need to run. You know, you need to compete in races. So they flew us to Flagstaff for one meet. I think it was with the East German athletes. And, you know, that was quite an experience, because they had to take little planes and fly over there and then fly back all within the same day. I think that that was the hardest thing, and probably the worst for my training, was not to have two or three competitions leading up to the games. And they didn't really want us to compete against each other, because they didn't want all-out war. You know how athletes can get when you do that. So that made it difficult. And for me, it was my first time away from home. So here we were, you know, in a hotel room, staying, you know, there, and Jan Glosser and I roomed together. But there was, my family wasn't there, and I was used to it, so I got really homesick. And when I went away to college, then after my senior year in high school, I didn't get homesick, because I'd already had that experience. But that was really hard for me, being lonely and away from home.
You mentioned the high-altitude training. Was that difficult for you to adjust to? Because I know it was the first games that was competed at high altitude. So we really want to know how that training differed from what you did prior to, and if it was difficult adjustment.
I think that since I ran the 400 meters, the oxygen debt, yes, always builds up. You know, people say the 400 meters is probably the hardest race to run, because it's an all-out sprint for the entire race. So you do get into oxygen debt, but it's not like the half mile and longer races where that oxygen is just going to make a huge difference in your race. What I noticed is that I didn't recover as fast. You know, the next day I was much more sore and tired than I would have normally been after my workout. And I can still remember going to the Atomic Energy Commission. They decided to study us and test our fat. So we went into this, and I can't remember what it was called, but it was a tube, kind of like what you would go into now for an MRI. And they would then give us a very accurate reading of our blood, our fat. And I can remember that the athletes, they had to readjust the scale because we were off the top of the chart. And I was at the very top except for one athlete. And wouldn't you know, it'd be Jarvis Scott. He had less body fat than I did, and she kept beating me. Up until that year, I had always beaten her. So it was like, gosh, where did she, you know, how did she get so all of a sudden?
Yeah. I'm going to switch gears a little bit here. Do you have any recollections of the Olympic Project for Human Rights and leading up to the games? Did you hear any of the rumors about a possible Olympic boycott or rumors of the protests from the black athletes?
I was real good with Ralph Boston. Ralph Boston had come over to represent Adidas and make sure we all had shoes and things. You know, he was training up in Lake Tahoe with the men's team. You know, he's one of our few athletes that has a whole set of Olympic medals, from gold, bronze, silver, and then he got bronze in the 68 games. But the black athletes had a huge meeting one night, and when they had this meeting and were... hang on a second. Here. Get in here. Anyway, they had a huge meeting, and they were outside. I was outside waiting for them to come out, and I mean, they really were seriously going to boycott the games and not compete. It was very stressful, very, you know, tough to watch it happen. And I think, if I remember right, one of the white athletes, I think it was one of the hurdlers, met with them and, you know, they tried to talk them into not boycotting. And I think that out of that kind of grew Carlos and Smith did with the black gloves. It came out of that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was really a stressful time. And I was friends with some of the guys on the Harvard rowing team, but I don't remember the letter at all. You know, again, I was 17. What kind of mailed, you know, put it onto my home in Phoenix that they sent a letter? I don't remember getting it. I just remember that we were in the staging area for the games to take off from was Denver, and we were there at the same time as the Harvard rowing team. But I don't remember anything about a letter from them.
Interesting. Well, let's go ahead and you talked about the staging area in Denver. Let's talk about both you traveled to Mexico City and just being in the Olympic Village and a little bit about what you can remember as far as getting to Mexico City, the feelings you were having, and kicking off the Olympic Games.
Well, you know, in Denver, they got us suitcases, they got our uniforms out. And I can remember, you know, again on the black athlete thread, our Olympic parade day uniform. You know, it was mostly a white dress. You're supposed to wear white nylons. And the black athletes said, well, they're trying to make us all look white. And, you know, there was that thread that ran throughout the games of the black athletes being treated unfairly. But as far as being in Denver and then getting on the plane, it was just totally exciting all the time. And in the Olympic Village, they had, you know, a center for the athletes to go to. And so you could meet people from all over the world that were like-minded like you were. And that, you know, to be an athlete at that level, you have to be pretty goal-driven and focused on that goal. And playing around and parties and going out all the time, just, it can't happen if you're going to be one of the best in the world. So it was fun to meet people like that, mm-hmm. that were the same common goal that I had.
Can you remember who you roomed with in the Olympic Village?
You know, I was looking at that, thinking that Francie Cracker roomed with me. There was another person that my mind is just, I don't remember, but it was like three people in a dorm room, I believe. And we had a bedspread that said Mexico 68 on it. And I still have that hanging at my cabin on the railing. I can remember one night in this little dorm bed dreaming that I was riding a bicycle and my calves were just so exhausted. I was just hurting so bad. And I woke up and I was having two cramps, one in each calf. And I think that was the high altitude. And oh man, they were sore. Oh goodness. For days afterwards. And we had cafeterias to go eat. We had to be careful not to eat any of the skin on any fruit because maybe we would get something from it. But the food was decent. You know, there's food. Cafeterias were open all day long anytime we wanted to go eat. I think the setup was really good because Mexico City had a hard time that time that year. I remember opening ceremony day. When we were on our bus going to opening ceremonies, the entire streets were lined with army troops because of the uprisings. And we were aware that things were happening. But again, we're kind of insulated as athletes, you know, still focused on going to the Olympics.
Mm-hmm. You spoke about the opening ceremonies. Did you march in the opening ceremonies?
Sure did. I was in third or fourth row on the inside towards the infield of the track. And it was so exciting, but it was long. And some of the athletes that were going to compete sooner didn't participate just because it does take a lot out of you to stand outside all those hours waiting to go in and then going in and standing. I can remember Ralph Boston, he had newspapers. He said when they released the Doves of Peace, those Doves of Peace might have just been fed, so you want to make sure you have something on your head.
Do you have any other reflections about the opening ceremony, or do you remember who you marched next to, or?
Well, Well, I was looking at the picture, kind of an interesting story there. My sister lived in Chardon, Ohio, and she was walking down the street on the square. There's a photography shop, and this huge blow-up was of opening ceremonies of black and white. She says, there's me, you know, there's my sister. So after the games, the photographer gave it to her. And I know that I was behind, I just can't remember who all I was with, but I was one of the, at 5'7", I wasn't all that short, but I was still short enough to be at the front. I think they arranged us from shortest to tallest.
Did you, when you were there, did you become particularly close with anybody on the team or even on other teams? Do you remember interactions that and friendships that were built?
I traded my Olympic sweatsuit with a girl from England, and I have her number, and I meant to look that up and look at the number on the back of the uniform, but I didn't get around to that. And I was going to see if I could, you know, that's one of the things I was going to do this summer, was to look up her name and see if I could find her on Facebook.
Oh, Facebook. It does get people back in touch.
Yeah, oh yeah, it does. Tom Lowe's been really good. He has the Olympic team set up on Facebook, so I see notes every once in a while from the athletes I do know. As far as friends, I made good friends with Ralph Boston. Spent a lot of time with him. And, you know, he knew what to do. You know, and he was calm, you know, and I think I was a little bit, I guess today's word, stressed out, but it was a lot of pressure to be ready to run.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that, you know, my actual competitions, I made it through the prelims to the semifinals, which was the top 16. You know, there were two races of eight each. And before my semifinals, you know, in Mexico City at that time of the year, if it was cloudy in the morning, the clouds would, you know, burn off, and the afternoon would be great. And if it was sunny in the morning, it would rain in the afternoon. So on the semifinals day, it was beautiful in the morning, and when I started warming up for my race, it started raining, and I got soaking wet. Where's the Phoenix? It never rains here. We never have to run in the rain. We're never cold and wet. And I can just remember between nerves and being wet and cold, just shaking. And now I drew lane one in the semifinals, and my last name, you know, was Drinkwater, and it poured rain hard, and all that water ran into lane one. Not that that made a difference in how I ran, because I didn't run well in semifinals at all. I ran very slow time. This was the lack of previous competitions. It was with the lack of experience. It's really, I didn't do what I wanted to do. I was just bitterly disappointed in my performance there. But Drinkwater ran in lane one, and it was full of water. Kind of a cute little story there. So I was in the top 16. I tell all the kids I teach, I'm a high school math teacher, want to know, you know, how I did. Did I win a medal? And I have to tell them, no, but you know, I made top 16 in the world. But that wasn't good enough. I really had expected myself to make finals.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of it, too. My goal was to make the team, and I didn't have a goal beyond that. And I think that when you have a goal that is, and you achieve it, 6 weeks isn't enough to change it to a new goal. So I wish that I would have continued training after that, but it wasn't to be. So I just had the one Olympic experience. You really have to honor somebody like Madeline Manning, who went to four or five Olympics in a row. You know, that's just an amazing feat.
Mm-hmm. Going to any Olympics is an amazing feat.
Oh, well, thank you. But, you know, I always kind of thought, because I didn't run well, that it wasn't as important an event.
Mm.
Or, you know, but now that I'm 60 years old, looking back at it, I think, wow, I guess that was pretty interesting. Unusual for me to make that team at that age, 17, mm-hmm. from a place like Phoenix that has so few women athletes.
Right. Do you have, of course, at the time, it's in 1968, at the time the Cold War is going on, and did you have any memories of athletes from the Soviet bloc or any interactions with those athletes?
I can remember Bill Toomey saying that you had to watch those athletes and the Eastern blocks because of their 5 o'clock shadows, and that was the women. So I don't know. I think that they did steroids. And I just put it right out there. I think they did steroids. I mean, some of them were just so muscular and so masculine looking. I just don't think that they could have developed that way on their own.
Mm. Speaking to that, I know also Mexico City Games were the first Olympic Games where there was disqualifications for doping and doping tests. Were you tested?
Oh, yeah. We all went. We had an appointment, and we went to the training center. And, I mean, really now, I was photographed naked. Okay, all of us were. They tested, they pinched us all for the fat, you know, took a look at, you know, our weight. I mean, it was very, you know, did the cheek cell to make sure that our insides of our cheeks, that they could fell out so they could tell if we were male or female, or we had an extra X chromosome. And, you know, they said it was for testing our body fat and for educational purposes. But as far as your doping, as far as to see if I had taken any steroids, no, I was never tested that way. Just the entire team was tested. Mm-hmm. And kind of an interesting, I did see Ralph Boston's body in a biology text. His face was blacked out, but it was him, you could tell. It was like, oh my goodness, please don't ever let me see myself.
The games were also obviously marked by several historic moments. You spoke about the Smith and Carlos Black Power salute, which has become kind of an iconic image of the games years later. But do you remember that event happening, and do you remember how it made you feel at the time, and has that changed now 40 years later?
I remember sitting watching it from the athlete section and thinking, oh my goodness, you know. And yet the black athletes had so much against them. There was so much prejudice, and it was out and out open prejudice against the athletes. It was really hard to watch how they were treated on a national level, not a daily way. As far as was it right or wrong, my feelings were they were paying attention to it, and compared to boycotting the games altogether, it was by far the least invasive protest that they could have had.
Mm-hmm. Also, the 68 games were the first games to take place in South America, Latin America specifically. Do you have any memorable impressions or any stories you want to tell about what it was like in Mexico City, both from a local perspective and what feelings you got from that, and also just any other significant things that you saw or that you witnessed or were involved in the city?
Well, you know, besides the uprisings and the troops on the first day of opening ceremonies, you know, shopping there was really fun. It was so colorful and so very different than the United States. I remember going out to see the pyramids and climbing to the top. You know, it was just, you know, fabulous to see the culture.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I think I was pretty focused on running.
Yeah, of course. Is there anything else you wanted to mention about being in Mexico City as far as your events?
Well, I was sitting just on the inside rail, right by the long jump pit, when Bob Beamon jumped his world record jump. I was right there. I witnessed it. I saw it. And right after that, you know, it stormed and rain started to fall. But most of the people moved up underneath the overhanging seats in the stadium. But I stayed down there because I wanted to see the rest of the jumping. And Ralph Boston came over to the other side and said, do you know how far that was? Because it was in meters instead of inches. And I was, no. And he goes, well, that was almost 30 feet. And I was like, oh, my goodness. I remember when Bob Beamon jumped, they had had a new way to measure. And it was like a telescope type on a rail that came out to the end, and it would line up, the judge would line it up and measure from that. Well, the rail didn't go far enough, so they had to hold up the competition while they got out a steel tape and measured his jump. And, you know, it was incredible. I mean, it stood for 30 years.
Yeah. Did you march in the closing ceremonies as well? And if so, where were you positioned, and what are your memories of that experience?
Well, you know, the weather, I didn't go to the closing ceremonies. My mom and dad, as school teachers, it was a big expense and a big deal for them. They found a way to get to Mexico City and see the games. And it rained, and my dad got real sick. Mm-hmm. So he went home, and I got real worried about him, and I was homesick anyway, so I went home when I was done competing and didn't stay for the closing ceremonies. I watched them on TV from Phoenix.
What happened immediately after the games? Did you have any downtime? Did you go back to training, go back to school, etc.? What was it
well,
like?
I took a couple weeks off of running, but then I started back in running. But I had a lot of school to catch up on because I was a senior. I had honors classes. I had work to do. And I had kept my math up pretty well. But the rest of it, I had, like, for 6 weeks, I think I did a chapter in my history book every week until I was caught up. I think I did a chapter every night for, like, 6 or 7 nights. That was incredibly fast. My teacher was amazed I could get caught up that fast, but I had a lot to do. So I was right back into the going-to-school routine and training.
What sort of reception did you have from your family and your friends when you got home?
They met me at the airport. My girlfriends ditched school. They were in high school also. And they cheered and yelled when I got off the plane. You know, and it was fun.
For you personally, what was the most meaningful part of participating in the games?
Well, it impacted my entire life. Because I don't think I'm that unusual. I think I'm a pretty average, normal person. And for me to compete in the games, it showed me the power of believing in yourself, the power of hard work, the power of thinking, yes, I can do this, I can make the games. And so for my entire life, I've been oriented to setting goals because I learned a lot about setting goals. As I told you earlier, I didn't set a goal of going past making the team. And that, as a coach myself with athletes, and I've helped them set goals. I remember one of my athletes who was standing talking one day along the railing watching the meet, and he goes, I don't know if I'm going to keep running or not. I only coached high school. He was in college. And I said, oh, well, why aren't you going to keep running? He said, oh, I just don't know if I'm good enough to make the team or not. And I just looked at him and I said, well, you know, somebody's got to make it. And he kept running then. He still runs. 20 years later, he's still running. He never made the team, but he at least tried.
Right.
And there's a lot to be said for setting goals and working towards them. You never know how high you're going to go if you don't set them high and go after it.
Along those same lines, like, what do you have one piece of advice that you would give to today's Olympic hopefuls?
What? Try to remember to be humble.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of people out there that are going to do a lot with their lives, and there's always going to be people shooting to beat you if you're one of the top athletes. And eventually they will. So if being number one is your only goal and the only thing you're looking at, it's not enough. You have to set a goal of being the best person you can be, the best all-around person, and remembering that everybody has things they're good at. So celebrate what you do and celebrate what they do.
This one's particularly important to our team, but What does the creation and preservation of this the 1906 U.S. Olympic team legacy mean to you as an athlete that competed on that team?
You know, Tom Lewis put in so much work on the whole thing. And to go back to St. Louis and have an actual reunion and see Madeline Manny and sit down and talk with her. Now, you know, I hadn't seen her since the Games. I mean, I hadn't seen any of those athletes since the Games. It was just phenomenal. Phenomenal amount of work, but just I think it was just finally to be recognized, too, as members of the team that we were Olympians.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we had the black district vote during that time and all that, it's just really, it has made a lot of difference to how I looked at myself in those games.
I know you touched on it a little bit, but if you could one more time, just what is the significance of the 68 games in your personal history and in your family's history? Just like you said, having been an Olympian, what significance does that play in your life?
Well, my brother that my family moved out to Arizona for became, after I made the Olympics and all, he became very famous mayor here in Arizona. He was mayor of Scottsdale. Is like a living legacy here in the United in Scottsdale, Arizona. And I always used to say, I was famous first, Herb. Because you're famous after me. I was famous first. That's why you got elected. I would always tease him about it. But he would always introduce me as his little sister, first woman from Arizona to make the track and field team for the United States. So, mm-hmm. He was very proud of me. And it would embarrass me. And I would always, turn red. And he'd love to embarrass me that way. But it was very touching of him to do that. And so did it mean something to me? Yeah. And he always introduced me that way. My mom and dad were real humble people, and they didn't say a whole lot about it to much of anybody. But they were proud of me, too. And I don't know how my life would have been different if I had not made the team. Making it at such a young age, perhaps I realized a goal, and then at 17, I made my goal. What? I was famous at 17 in a way, but now, after that, I've never been that famous again. So did it affect my life? I don't know. I don't know what it would have been like if I hadn't. But making it sure did make a difference to me at the time, and it's something that I've always looked back on with mixed emotions, because I didn't compete as well as I wanted to. But on the other hand, I was there, and for every athlete that has ever run a race, compared to athletes who go to the games, it's a very small portion of the people that make the team. So I think I'm more proud the older I get that I did manage to make a team.
Do you want to talk a little bit? I know this wasn't on my script, but a little bit about your involvement in track and field now. You mentioned that you were a coach.
I'm not coaching at the moment because our school district has this nepotism rule. In 2003, both my husband and I were head coaches. I was the head women's coach at Chapel High School. He was the head men's coach. And we coached cross country and we coached track for years. And we retired. And the man that they found to be head coach just couldn't, he came from the college ranks, and high school coaches do a lot of developing of athletes. They do not, we don't have the talent just all of a sudden come and be able to race. Mm-hmm. Now that might be more of a college level coach. You have to develop them as high school. So this man quit halfway through the next season, and my husband couldn't stand that because we had a really good team. So he went back to coaching. But at that time, our district had done away with the women's head position, and he wasn't allowed to hire me back. So I haven't coached since 2003 because of that.
Mm.
So that's a little side story.
Yeah.
But I've always had really good relationships with my athletes that were serious runners and trained them, had a lot of fun. Our last year, we had athletes that were really really talented. We almost won the state meet. We were within a few points of it. My 4x1 girls team won the 4x1, and we didn't have really fast girls. We just had well-trained girls. So it was really fun to work with high school kids for all these years. And we did both women and men's. So we were head coaches, but we were really co-coaches. And the Olympic Association sent us a keychain not long ago. And it says on the back of it, once an Olympian, always an Olympian, never former, never past.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a really cool thing for them to have done for us. And that's my keychain. I read it every day.
Well, that's all I have, but I will let you, you know, if there's anything else or another story or anything you want to tell or you feel like we've missed, you can go ahead and speak freely about that if you'd like.
I think we've covered a lot. It's been an hour, hasn't it?
It's close to 40 minutes, yeah.
And I'm sure you've heard enough about me speaking, so I'm going to let you go and be on with your life and on with your job, and I thank you for working on this. It's very nice of you.
Well, we thank you very much as well for participating. And like we said, this is about the Olympians themselves, and it's capturing their stories, and hopefully can preserve that for their families and for you, obviously.
You know, you'd ask me about, I know there's one thing I did write down here on my little notes that I don't think we've hit, and that was, you know, did I become close to anybody on the team?
Mm-hmm.
And Nancy Schaefer was an 800-meter runner, 400-meter runner, and she was the alternate. So, in fact, she was an alternate 4 years later. And so she never got to go to the Olympics, but she was an alternate. And she was one of the reasons I went to the College of Worcester for one of their first track teams. I was actually on their very first track team. There were three of us. And so I became close to Nancy Schaefer. And then another athlete was Doris Brown. And, you know, we kind of did this indoor circuit through, you know, the winter months. And so we travel and see Doris Brown all the time. And so she became one of those people that I looked up to because I was... Did I lose you?
I'm still here.
Okay, so, you know, traveling the circuit and seeing Doris Brown on a weekly basis, spend a lot of time together, going to dinner and things like that.
Mm.
So that's all I think I have here. So I appreciate again what you've done and have a good day.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
All righty.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.